Funding for the Think podcast comes from TCU, exploring renewable and sustainable energy sources to power a clean energy future. Stories of research can be found at endeavors.tcu.edu.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How many of us long to be physically healthier, mentally sharper, and emotionally happier? My guest today says the path to all those benefits, as well as a stronger economy and more sustainable lifestyle, should lead us outside to engage with the natural world the way our parents and grandparents did. Author Richard Louv is founding chairman of the Children and Nature Network and author of the book Last Child in the Woods. His new book is called The Nature Principle, Human Restoration and the End of Nature Deficit Disorder. Rich, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
So you wrote first about kids suffering from a lack of exposure to nature. What helped you realize that their parents had the same problem?
Well, in the original book, in Last Child in the Woods, I talked about what I called nature deficit disorder. And I was careful always to say that's not a known medical diagnosis. Perhaps it should be, but it's not yet. It is a way, though, to think about this disconnect between kids and nature that we've been seeing growing for at least three decades. So when I was out, speaking about that issue, et cetera, oftentimes adults would say what one woman in Seattle said when she kind of literally picked me up by my lapels and said, "Listen to me, adults have nature deficit disorder too. You got to write a book about that." Hmm. And I said, "Let me go." And I wrote that down and put it in my wallet, and I thought about it quite a bit. And everywhere I went, people said that. Also, the Children and Nature movement, which has emerged since Last Child in the Woods came out, has made clear, I think, that that movement will not survive unless adults see what's in nature for themselves, whether or not they have kids of their own. So that's primarily why I wrote The Nature Principle.
It's interesting that in today's world, for a lot of people, the idea of spending a night alone in the woods is somehow more terrifying than spending the night in like a polluted, crime-ridden urban neighborhood.
Well, I think that there's a generalized fear in society, and those two things are really related. What I found among children, but even more about among adults, is the fear of strangers, which has grown considerably, even though when you actually look at the numbers, stranger danger, for instance, stranger abductions have been going down for about 25 years. Hmm. In fact, violent crime against children and violent crime in general has been going down fairly sharply in recent years. That was recently reported. Then why do we feel this growing fear, which sometimes gets translated, in fact, into a fear of nature itself? I think our profession has to own some of that. I like to think it's not us print guys, but it's us too. All you have to do is watch CNN or Fox, and you'll see how they take a handful of terrible crimes against children in particular and repeat those over and over and over again until we think that there is a boogeyman in every clump of trees and on every street corner. Hmm. That I think, is the definition of conditioning. I think we're being conditioned to live in a state of fear.
And in some ways, the same coverage happens, you know, when a wildcat walks off a mountain somewhere and walks into a neighborhood. That's also broadcast around the world.
Yeah, I mean, a bear near where I live wandered down, a very rare bear. I mean, one probably wanders through the mountains in the East County of San Diego, where I live, every few years. And one wandered into a town on the edge, and somebody shot it. And there was really no reason for that, but this fear.
So we like to imagine that our ancestors had almost supernatural abilities to navigate the world outside. But as you have discovered, and there are a lot of scientists looking at this, many people walking around today can develop extraordinary sensitivity if they pay attention. Can you talk about that?
Well, that's true. In the first chapter of The Nature Principle, which is called Singing for Bears, and I'll tell you why in a second, I talk about the recent science, which really shows that, you know, human beings don't just have five senses or even that sixth metaphorical one. People who study the human senses really talk now about as many as 30 senses. An example of how nature brings those senses out in us. You know, I was in Alaska with my younger son. We were fishing on Kodiak Island, and we were wandering up a stream, and the guide taught us how to smell for bears.
Hmm.
Now, usually what you do is you sing for bears. You make a lot of noise. You talk and you sing because you really don't want to surprise one of these Alaskan brown bears. So once you've smelled that odor, which is quite pungent, it's a combination of bear musk and rotten salmon because the bears like to roll in the salmon, you never forget it. And we smelled it, and the guide said that means one of two things. Either the bear is right there in the bushes, or the bear has just left.
Hmm.
And it turns out that a study was done not long after we got back from Kodiak using college students, and they found that human beings have some bloodhound in us that we can actually track with our noses. With blindfolds on and ears plugged, we can track with our noses, not as well as a bloodhound, but we have that physiological ability that we've basically forgotten about. And there's a whole host of other senses. We have some of the echolocation abilities that bats have. Some people who have lost their sight are being trained in how to use that sense. Soldiers in war zones are being studied in Iraq. The ones who can see the nuances or sense that something is wrong down that alley, and the military is actually studying them. What they found is that the people who have that ability come from one of two places, either the inner city or they come from rural areas where they spend a lot of time in nature.
And the inner city kids or young soldiers are people who had to be particularly aware of potential threats.
Right. And when you look at some of the effects of spending more time in nature on young people and adults in terms of their ability to learn, this has something, I believe, with the use of the senses, the full use of the senses, all of our senses at the same time. I mean, other than a New York subway, when do most of us use all of our senses at the same time? So there are a lot of these studies that are really just coming out in the last 10 or 15 years in increasing numbers that really suggest that if we really want to have good education reform, we'll get our kids outdoors and we'll get ourselves outdoors. Businesses are starting to learn this too.
Rich, what does time in nature contribute to our intelligence?
Well, the studies have shown, for instance, the backpackers, wilderness backpackers. One group went on a wilderness backpacking trip, and they actually, when they came back, they showed improved proofreading performance.
Hmm.
After just an hour of interacting with nature, their memory performance and attention spans improved by 20%, according to a study at the University of Michigan. There's also the impact on just not only of going into nature, but of bringing nature into our buildings. The schools with larger windows and more views of nearby nature from the classrooms and the lunchrooms, et cetera, those schools, the students in them, had higher standardized test scores and higher graduation rates, and even a greater percentage of these students planned to attend college. The workplace, this is also being discovered to have a real impact. The something called biophilic design has been emerging, which incorporates nature into the design of workplaces, into the buildings, the land around them, but also inside the buildings. And what they're finding is that workers are more productive, sick time goes down, attendance or turnover rate gets better. So business is recognizing this as well.
And then there's this emerging field in design called biomimicry. And recently we did a show about a guy who wanted to design a boat that was seaworthy. And they looked at a lot of different animals and natural shapes in order to sort of create this thing. What we do is we find what works in nature and then we adapt it to suit our own needs.
That's right. That's associated with this, is, you know, a greater awareness of nature leads us to better design decisions. One of the people who studies this points out that the inner shell of a sea creature, of an abalone, is twice as tough as our high-tech ceramics. Hmm. That we're learning a lot from bats and from other animals. There's an award-winning mall in Africa, a very modern, wonderful mall that is designed using the techniques learned by looking at termite mounds in Africa. That these termite mounds, the ones that are taller than a human being, they have a kind of built-in air conditioning system, among other efficiencies, that is really quite remarkable. So the people have studied this, and they've applied that to the construction of shopping malls.
We should point out here, if it's not already clear, that you are not a Luddite. You're not suggesting we toss out our technology, just that we realize that its utility has limits.
That's right. I'm not, I'm actually talking on a telephone right now. So you can't escape it. I like my iPhone. I like my computer way too much. I'm resisting getting an iPad because I know I'd be right down the rat hole if I got that.
You could use it to identify plants out there if you wanted.
Well, I can do that on my iPhone, actually,
yeah.
And bird calls, too. So I'm not anti-tech at all, really. It's more a sense of balance. One of the bumper sticker slogans, I think, in the Nature Principle is the more high-tech our lives become, the more nature we need.
Hmm.
It's true that that technology really enhances our lives in many ways, but we have yet to fully or even adequately study how being in the natural world improves our intelligence and our health and our happiness. So it's a sense of balance, both in the research but also in our lives, that I think I'm promoting.
You stress the need to cultivate what you call a hybrid mind. What is that?
Some of the studies that have shown the impact of the natural world or bringing the natural world into the workplace, et cetera, really suggests that this isn't a zero-sum game. It's not either-or technology or nature in terms of stimulating our intelligence and creativity. The best example of this is a guy I met who teaches people how to become the pilots of cruise ships. He said he gets two kinds of students. One kind grew up mainly inside, playing video games and on computers and electronics, etc. He said, they have a lot of talent. They're very good at the electronics. I need that on my ships. I need their talent. But he said the second kind of student grew up outside for the most part. They grew up hunting and fishing and camping, et cetera. He said those kind of students also have great talent. He said they actually know where the ship is. And he wasn't being cute when he said that. He was being serious. He said literally they have a sense of where the ship is in space, in a spatial sense. And then when you look back at some of the studies of the senses, there are a cluster of those almost 30 senses that science talks about that have to do with our ability to know where we are, literally, in a spatial area. So when people spend more time outdoors, apparently they really fine-tune that in a way that we just can't do if we're staring at a screen all day. So his summation was the perfect student to him would be the student who has both sets of abilities, both the electronic abilities, but also the abilities that come from spending more time in nature, and I call that the hybrid mind.
My guest is journalist and author Richard Lube. He's founding chairman of the Children and Nature Network and author of the new book, The Nature Principle, Human Restoration and the End of Nature Deficit Disorder. Join the conversation now by calling in. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Thank you.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author and journalist Richard Louvre. He's founding chairman of the Children and Nature Network and author of the new book, The Nature Principle, Human Restoration and the End of Nature Deficit Disorder. Join the conversation now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Rich, we worry so much these days about our health and how to maintain it and how much it's going to cost. What sort of power does nature have to heal us?
Well, this is where some of the first studies were done, even before the intelligence studies were done. It does seem to have a profound effect on us. We're looking for one reason. It's just the practical fact that if we move less, we're going to be less healthy, and that we've now got a sedentary lifestyle. In fact, there's a study just this morning that was reported about that our workplaces really are part of the reason for the obesity epidemic. I would also say our schools are part of that reason. I would say that spending more time in front of computers is part of that reason. Now we know that nearly one in five young U.S. adults, this was just announced, may have high blood pressure. One in five. Pediatricians are no longer talking about, they're no longer talking about type 2 diabetes or adult onset and diabetes because it begins in children now. So we've really got a situation where our health is being challenged. And if we get more exercise, obviously that helps. But then if we get more exercise in nature, there seems to be a value added that we don't really understand. Studies of joggers in Sweden who exercise in a natural green setting, with trees and landscape views, compared to people who jog, for instance, on a treadmill indoors, those two groups expending the same number of calories, expending the same amount of energy, they've measured this. The people on the treadmills, yeah, they get healthier, their blood pressure gets better, their psychological health gets better, et cetera. But the people who expend the same amount of energy in green exercise, either jogging or hiking or gardening outside in nature, they get even better. Hmm. So there's this value added, this margin of improvement that, again, we don't really understand because this area is terribly understudied. But in a number of ways, nature really has an effect on us. Quite some time ago, in fact, Pennsylvania researchers found that patients in rooms with views of trees had shorter hospitalizations by almost a full day and less need for pain medications and even fewer negative comments in the nurse's notes compared to patients who just had a view of brick walls or man-made environment.
And this is inside the same hospital at some point.
Exactly. Yeah. And so in many ways, and in fact, even in terms of our immune systems, the stress hormones seem to be less when we are in native, in natural settings compared to urban settings. In quite a few ways, this is beginning to change the way that healthcare, particularly in some of the other countries like Japan and some of the Scandinavian countries, are viewing our relationship with the natural world. It's also beginning to change in the U.S. Back in October, I was asked to be the keynote speaker to the American Academy of Pediatrics, their national conference. There was a lot of interest among those 3,000 pediatricians and pediatric nurse practitioners in using nature in their practices. In fact, some are beginning to prescribe nature. There's a great program in Portland, Oregon, where pediatricians are working with park officials, with the urban parks, where they're prescribing, essentially, nature. And after the family gets that prescription, the park department calls them and says, here's what we got to offer. Come out to our park. They go to the park. They fulfill the prescription, and they get it signed off by the park ranger, and now they're going to study that over time, this partnership between the parks and the pediatricians, and see how it affects health long term.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. My guest is Richard Louv, author of The Nature Principle, Human Restoration and the End of Nature Deficit Disorder. You can also get to us via email to think@kera.org. Let's go on the phones now to Maggie in Fort Worth. Hey, Maggie.
Hello. I'm glad you have a hold button because I could just go on for the next 30 minutes on this.
Just give us a quick point. We're happy to hear from you.
I have a background as a park naturalist, National Park Service, all over the place, thinking, wow, I'm going to have these wild nature children. But as a park ranger moving around, I found that that was one thing, but as a parent with kids in school and mortgage and all that, we stay put. And so I've tried to teach my kids about the environment that's around them, and when we travel, they get my expertise. Can't help it. I can't turn it off. But I still find that my kids spend a distressing amount of time indoors. They know how to find this information. They know they can ask mom. They know that I don't go to the gym. I garden. I walk the dogs. I can't understand a culture that has people paying other people to mow their lawns while they drive to the gym to work out. That just doesn't make sense to me. So I see a lot of disconnects, and I guess the best thing I can do for my kids is just try to set an example that they'll eventually fall back on.
Well, thanks for your call. What do you think about that, Rich?
I agree with everything the caller said. I mean, that is what we experience as parents. It is a struggle. It's a struggle to get our kids into nature. It's a struggle to get ourselves into nature. This isn't particularly easy for me either. I have to, you know, remind myself constantly to get outdoors and to go on hikes and go fishing, because I know if I don't do it, after a while, I start to get depressed. I don't do well if I don't get into nature. And I think this is common. This is part of who we are, part of our humanity. As of 2008, only as of 2008, most people in the world now live in cities. That happened to us in the U.S. in the 1940s, but now it's the whole world. The whole world is living in cities. So what that means, as that continues, is one of two things. Either human beings will lose their connection to nature, with huge implications for that, or we'll build new kinds of cities, new kinds of neighborhoods, new kinds of workplaces, new kinds of homes, new kinds of schools. That we actually can bring nature into our lives. And I think actually that nearby nature, and your caller suggested this, nearby nature is every bit as important as wilderness to human health and well-being.
And sometimes people who are living, you know, Dallas is a city, it's an urban area, but a lot of people live on streets that might look more like a suburb in some other cities. There's nature around us that we tend not to notice sometimes.
That's true. A lot of this has to do with looking, I mean, with actually being aware. And in the nature principle I talk about, what I call the incredible wonder of being where you are, of actually beginning to notice. When I travel, and I travel way too much, I make myself leave the hotel and go find nature. And I walk in, even in the densest urban cities, you can find some nature if you really look for it. And then when I find it, I take out my iPhone, and I take a picture of it and send it to my wife. But in terms of looking and being aware, our backyards can be amazing places. I mean, we could plant the plants that bring back butterfly migration routes. Kids can get involved with that. Families can get involved with that. Right now, as I'm talking with you, I'm looking out into my backyard, which, believe me, we don't mow it, and it looks it. But, you know, I love the natural look that it has. But the animals that come through my backyard are part of my social life. The possums and all of that are part of what I call human nature's social capital. I mean, why is it when we talk about social capital, we only talk about human beings? What about all these other critters that are around us, all these other species? For some reason, in our backyard for the last couple of years, we've had a lot of lizards, a lot of fence lizards, and now and then an alligator lizard. And I'll sit here, like I am right now, and I'll consciously look away from my computer, and I'll watch these lizards, and they make me laugh. I mean, they are, you know, there's more posturing out there among those lizards than there is in Congress, and they make me laugh, and that's kind of the point. They don't know they're part of my social health, but I know it if I look, if I'm aware.
Yeah, that's a great point. And, you know, you write in the book about, you know, one way that we can reengage with nature is to turn our yards over to growing food, which is, you know, wonderful for us. It's good health to garden. But at the very least, we can ensure that the property we own is a sort of sanctuary for the wildlife that is native to the area.
That's right. And I mean, there's rules to this to reduce the problems that can come with that. I mean, don't feed the wild animals. That's one. But cities actually are beginning to think about this. Again, Portland and there are other cities, Santa Fe, there are other cities that are actually beginning to think about wilding their city. In Portland, for instance, the most productive peregrine falcon nest in the whole state is in downtown Portland. Bald eagles are back in downtown Portland. Beavers are back, too, and they've even had to introduce something called beaver deceivers. That's a contraption they put in the water in the culvert so that the beavers can travel through but not dam the culvert. Again, the studies show that this improves human health and well-being and our psychological health. Parks that have the highest biodiversity and urban neighborhoods with the highest biodiversity have the people with the best psychological health. There seems to be an association there. So really, when we begin to think about how to enrich our lives and make to simply feel more alive, you know, when I was writing the book, I kept thinking about health and intelligence, et cetera. But ultimately, I thought, you know what this comes down to for children and for adults? Most of us want to feel more alive. And much of our society right now makes us feel less alive when we spend so much time in front of computers, when we're constantly assaulted by media messages and advertising, et cetera, in ways we don't even realize, we're not feeling more alive. When we sit there late at night and flip through the channels, like I sometimes catch myself doing, I guarantee you, if you monitor how you feel after you've done that for a while late at night, you don't feel enlightened. You probably feel depressed.
No, it feels like you've eaten McDonald's. I know, if you watch TV for 2 hours, it feels like you've eaten McDonald's or something. Mentally.
So that much of life now makes us feel less alive, and nature is right there. I mean, it's waiting for us to help us feel more alive, and it's very cost-effective. You know, the caller mentioned, you know, the cost of mowing the lawn, hiring somebody to mow the lawn, and then the cost of going to a gym and paying monthly fees. In England now, they're starting something called green gyms, in which families and individuals, adults and kids, are starting to agree to show up at the park and hike together or do gardening together, and they call that green gyms. It's a lot less expensive than joining a gym that you never go to.
We have an email here from Bob who writes, I wonder about the relationship between nature and spirituality. We who live in cities with so much artificial light have forgotten the awesome sight of the Milky Way in the night sky, and I suspect we've also forgotten to ponder who we are in the context of an infinite universe.
I think that's true. I think that's true on a personal level. I mean, Wendell Berry, the great poet, has a wonderful quote. He says, you can't know who you are until you know where you are. I think that's true in terms of personal psychology. It's also true in terms of our spirits. When Last Child in the Woods came out, which was about kids, and again, the nature principle is about kids, but it's more about adults, whether or not they have kids. When that first came out, I was worried about it because there was a chapter at the end of the book that was about the spiritual necessity of nature for children. I was very careful with that chapter. I have a very conservative Christian friend who went through it and helped me with it a bit. She's quoted in it. But I still worried because some people think incorrectly, that somebody like me is going to come along and try to convince their kids to worship nature. I don't do that. But what happened was really interesting. I've gotten no flack from the Christian conservatives. In fact, one of the first champions of Last Child in the Woods was the president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. I was asked to be on the 700 Club at the Christian Broadcasting Network, and they did a good job on the piece. And I came to the conclusion that smart religious people or spiritual people of whatever kind, I think, have an intuitive understanding that all spiritual life begins with a sense of wonder. What's one of the first windows into wonder that we have? You know, I remember crawling out to the edge of the yard and where the trees and the bushes began, and turning over a rock and finding out for the first time that I wasn't the only person in the universe, I wasn't alone in the universe. I had this sense of kinship with what I saw under that rock, the animals, the animal life, the plant life, hearing wind in the trees for the first time. How can we shut that window? And that's what we're doing for many kids. And we can't shut that window for ourselves either.
Well, you know, it makes certain sense. I think it makes sense that if you believe that, you know, God gave us the earth, we made the buildings, but God made the trees and the earth and the oceans and things like that. And people have to recognize that, I would think.
I think that there is a movement in the among many churches and synagogues. There's an awareness of this now, I think, more in many religions in the United States, that we really need to honor and respect that sense of awe that we do get from nature, even when nature is not nice, like recently with the tornadoes. Mm-hmm. I grew up with tornadoes outside of Kansas City. I know that fear. I watched one of the biggest ones in history go past my house when I was, I think, 7 years old, and I've never forgotten it. It killed 50 people. But that sense of awe and wonder that stands right next to the tragedy.
My guest is Richard Louv. He's founding chairman of the Children and Nature Network and author of the new book, The Nature Principle, Human Restoration and the End of Nature Deficit Disorder. If you want to join the conversation, call us now at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist and author Richard Louv. He's founding chairman of the Children and Nature Network and author of the new book, The Nature Principle, Human Restoration and the End of Nature Deficit Disorder. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Rich, as you mentioned earlier, more than half the world's population now lives in cities. As we know, those cities are getting denser and taller all the time. One, at least, solution to some of the lack of nature in those really dense cities is the potential to put up something called vertical farms. Can you tell us a little bit about these?
These are essentially high-rises or even skyscrapers that are on the drawing board. I mean, these really intriguing designs have been created of these. Some of them, they come in different forms. Some of them come with a kind of a spiral garden that goes up the outside of the skyscraper, and then they have ways of capturing rainwater that move down the spiral so that people inside that building can walk right outside to their garden, even if they're on the 31st floor, and tend the garden, and it can grow produce, can grow flowers, et cetera. The presence of that garden is biophilic in the sense that it helps human restoration. It would help people be healthier and happier. But it could also be quite productive, even in the densest of cities. That's one example of really what's sometimes being called the new agrarianism, which can be everything from vertical farms to, in Detroit, some of the neighborhoods that have been decimated by people moving out of Detroit and the buildings razed, those lots are now becoming big community gardens where people are raising produce and selling it and using it. But it also can be vanguard ranching, as it's called, a new kind of ranching and farming, or the rise of organic gardening. I met Michael Pollan a few weeks ago, who wrote The Omnivore's Dilemma and other books about this, and we spent a couple hours talking about this. We actually had lunch, by the way. Whenever dining with Michael Pollan, be sure to order what Michael Pollan orders. And it was interesting because we agreed that we came to nature from different directions. I came to nature through the woods behind my house as a kid. I loved those woods. They were my woods. He came to nature feeling kind of nervous about the woods. He came to nature not through the woods, but through his garden. He liked the order of the garden, but he loved growing things. He loved the life that would appear before him. We should be part of the same movement. And I actually make the case in the Nature Principle, and I elaborate on that a little bit in an essay that people can read if they go to natureprinciple.org or .com, natureprinciple.org, in which I outline the seven reasons that we need a new nature movement. It needs to be much bigger than than environmentalism. Environmentalism right now is kind of a pup tent. We need a big tent that would include all kinds of people, some of which I've just named, some of those movements I've just named. If we had that under one tent, we would be, I think, much more powerful than we are. One of the things that I've noticed, and I talk about this in the Nature Principle, but I've really noticed it recently, and this is really, I think, troubling to me and others when they think about it. When people think about the future, what images come first to mind about the far future? I think for most Americans, the images that come forth first are of Blade Runner and Mad Max, a kind of post-apocalyptic future. Yes, some see a positive future through technology, but I don't think robots servicing us is a complete image, is a completely good future. Why is it that we see this almost apocalyptic vision before us? I think that is a dangerous fixation if that's the only future we're seeing. Martin Luther King said in many ways that any culture will fail if it cannot paint a picture of a world that people will want to go to. His speech, as others have said, was not called "I Have a Nightmare." He really painted a picture of a world that we could imagine happening in terms of the relations between cultures and races. Some of that came true because we imagined it first, because he helped us see that. What future are we seeing now? I think that when we begin to envision a future in which nature is much more part of our lives, that our lives are as immersed in nature every day as they are in technology, that's a pretty good future to think about going toward. Really interesting cities can come from that principle. Great houses, great workplaces, great lives, I think, more health. So I think that we really need to begin to imagine a different future. And I think we actually need a new nature movement to help us get there.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Thomas in Louisville. Hi, Thomas.
Hi, how are you all doing today?
Great, thanks.
Liz, I've made an observation or two over the past several weeks with young children. You're talking about the computers and sitting in front of the computer screen and all. If you've got a 18, 19-month-old child out on the porch drawing pictures with chalk, fiddling around in the tomato plants, you know, messing with the shrubbery, whatever. Dad pulls out an iPad, okay? Everything stops for the child. The child is on that iPad, wants to touch it, wants to feel it, wants to, you know, just everything else has gone null and void. And there's an old military term that, you know, if you take care of your equipment will take care of you. It's the same thing with nature. If we take care of nature, then Mother Nature will take care of us. And the big problem that we have today with children, with grown people, all the way across is we are not using these computers. These computers are now using us. And you got a great show. Love listening to you. Peace and love. And I do plan on reading your book, sir. Have a great day.
Thanks for your call. What do you think about that, Rich?
I think that was quite eloquent. Again, you know, I think we have to be careful not to blame it specifically on technology, on the computers, because that's not going to go away. We really have to, everything he said is true, but we really have to shift our gaze to what we do get from nature, how we feel more alive in it. We have to be far more intentional about that. We have to put down the iPad long enough to experience all of our senses at the same time in nature. If we don't do that as adults, I'll guarantee it that future generations of children will not do that. And at some point, we could become a denatured society. A denatured society ultimately is a dehumanized society. I don't think that's the future we want to go to.
Back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Jim in Fort Worth. Hi, Jim.
Chris, thank you for making us all think.
Oh, it's very kind of you. I'm happy to be here.
Rich, at one point I had the great fortune to be able to spend about 18 months camping, just moving across the country on the back roads, living outside, jumping from national park to national park. It was unbelievably amazing to me how rapidly I sensed noticeable improvements in all of my senses, sight, smell, hearing, feel, touch. My question is, to what extent are those kinds of benefits documented, and what in terms of social policy, and if you would come at this primarily from the private sector's point of view with respect to controlling healthcare costs, what kind of steps might employers be able to take in order to encourage those kinds of behaviors, which would, I think, improve the health of their employee base?
Well, first, the first part of the question about how documented is this improvement that you felt, and certainly I feel, and many of us feel when we do get out to hike and you know, and be in the natural world, to our health, our psychological health, et cetera. It's finally being documented. I mean, in the last decade, and that's I report on this much of this in the Nature Principle. Finally, in the last decade, for children and adults, we're seeing a lot of correlative studies, not causal studies, because very few of them go back 30 years. We don't have the 30-year longitudinal studies. In fact, when I talked to the pediatricians, when I spoke to them at that national conference, they said, I know that you want the 30-year longitudinal studies. My question to you is, where were you 30 years ago when you should have started them? That there are over 1,000 studies of how Ritalin and other stimulants affect the symptoms of attention deficit disorder. There are less than a dozen about the natural world's impact on attention deficit disorder. That's not because of the relative merits of those two approaches to therapy. That's because of where the research money comes from. So we're finally beginning to see documentation of this, and it's impressive, and I report on that in the Nature Principle for both children and adults. We're also starting to see some different thinking. I mentioned Portland. There are other places. In the UK, they're now talking about augmenting antidepressants with more time in nature. There's a charity called MIND, M-I-N-D. It's the biggest mental health charity in the United Kingdom. They came out with a report a couple of years ago that says we can only go so far down this road of antidepressants. They weren't against antidepressants. They just said there's a limit. And at the end of that road is nature, and we need to begin to prescribe people going out into the natural world, and they will get better, many of them. Not all, but many of them will. In terms of cost savings, this is pretty cost-effective. In the UK, in fact, they're talking about almost tongue-in-cheek starting a natural health system to exist alongside their national health system. Basically, the idea being this is a way we can bring physical and mental therapy to people that actually doesn't cost as much as much of what we already do.
Yeah, if you think about it, and you talk about the concept of button parks, which are these tiny little parks in urban areas that can just be a respite from, the concrete and buildings and everything. One of those can be built for less than it costs often to care for one person with a critical disease related to lifestyle.
That's right. And people can begin to do this for themselves in their own, the button park idea I suggest in the Nature Principle, where, what if neighborhoods could apply the legal systems of land trust to their own neighborhood to preserve that little piece of land that their children love and they love? What if somebody cared about the woods as much as I did when I was a kid? Those woods might still be there. It might still be producing the happiness and health that they produced when I was a kid. There's a lot, the caller also mentioned, and I neglected that, was what can employers do? This is beginning to happen, and in the Nature Principle, I talk about a lot of companies, and some of them quite big, but there's another huge furniture company that has really radically changed their the design of their building. Designers are now beginning to call these places high-performance workplaces when they incorporate nature into them, and it's because people are more productive in them, and sick time goes down and so forth. People are healthier in them. The reports of so-called sick building syndrome go way down in the work environments in which nature is part of this. So there's all kinds of ways that we can improve our lives. Employers can, in terms of public policy, we can improve our lives. But it really comes down to the decisions that we're making right now today, in terms of, are we going to put that iPad down long enough to walk outside and inhale nature and feel what it feels like, and feel how much better we feel when we get at least a dose of that a day.
When you go out and speak about your work, do you ever run into people who don't get it, who say, I disagree with this, we don't spend enough time indoors?
I have yet to meet somebody who says we ought to spend more time indoors. Uh-huh. I mean, so, a few people, sometimes people on the more extreme side of environmentalism have a problem with what I say, because deep down they don't think people should be in nature. They want people out of nature. I remind them that I'm not just talking about people going out into wilderness. I'm talking about creating nature. The conservation is no longer enough for the biodiversity that we need. We need to start creating it. As ironic as that sounds, we can begin to build neighborhoods that have higher human density but also more natural habitat through green roofs and a lot of other techniques that can improve our lives greatly. So I don't hear a lot of resistance on that at all. But I think that the resistance is in terms of action. What actions are we going to take? How are we going to actually act on this rather than just wring our hands about, our children not going outside anymore? And a lot is happening all over the country, all over the world now.
Richard Louv is founding chairman of the Children and Nature Network. His new book is called The Nature Principle, Human Restoration and the End of Nature Deficit Disorder. Rich, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Oh, I really appreciate it. Thanks to the callers, too.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.